right? It kind of calls into legitimacy the divine nature of the Holy Quran. Some people might say that what's going on here is the Quran just simply copying what these Arabian poets from the Age of Ignorance said, right? So, you know, how can we defend the miraculousness of the Holy Quran, the fact that it's been revealed from God, when we see that it's clearly copying some phrases from here and there, and from other people, from human beings, right? Okay, so we can answer this question in a number of different ways. One of the ways that we can answer it is this, and this is a very simple answer. If anybody thinks about it, it makes sense, right? The Quran was revealed to a certain group of people, right? The Quran was revealed to a certain group of people. Therefore, right, it's true that the Quran is a book for all of humanity, but it was revealed to a certain group of people. And therefore, by force, it has no choice but to use that language of those people, right? The Quran refers to this in many verses of the Holy Quran. Right? It has to use the language of those people. It has to use phrases and expressions that those people are accustomed to and are used to. Right? You can't say that God Almighty is using here words that people have already used. Right? No, he has to because he wants to convey those thoughts to these people who don't know any language or any other expressions besides the ones that they're using. Right? So this doesn't call into question the Quran's miraculousness or negate its divine nature. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the Quran and its use of phrases from the era of ignorance. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. The end of the fake regime of Israel is writ large on the wall, says Ayman Ahmad, journalist, in an article published under the heading Zionist Israel's Impending Doom. Here's the details. Like all oppressors, the Zionist entity displays two contradictory traits: extreme cruelty towards the Palestinians under occupation and fear of resistance. This has led some Israeli regime officials to express deep concern about its survival. Take Ehud Barak. He's no pacifist or alarmist since he had served as both the regime's army chief and as prime minister. He has said that the Zionist entity may not live to see its 80th birthday. The 80th year curse, as it is called, is part of Jewish history. No Jewish regime has lasted longer than 80 years. There is no reason to believe its present iteration would live past this time frame. There are good reasons for this grim prognosis. There are both internal and external reasons for this. The vast majority of Israeli citizens do not believe it would last long. This explains their obsession with getting a second passport, mostly of some European country. Clearly, they do not believe an Israeli passport provides enough security. When Tel Aviv Airport was opened for international flights soon after the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza ended in May 2021, some 50,000 Israeli citizens fled occupied Palestine. In addition to their historical fear, and it may well come to pass, there are also more pressing immediate concerns. One is the Palestinians' refusal to be cowed down despite the Zionist extreme brutality and its brazen support by Western regimes. The latest example of this was witnessed in the executioner-style killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghla on May 11th. She was shot and killed by an Israeli regime sniper outside Jenin refugee camp, despite wearing a jacket clearly marked in bold letters as press. Western regimes, led by the US and joined by others like Canada, Britain, and a host of Europeans, merely called for an investigation into the death of Abu Aghla. They could not even bring themselves to admit that she was murdered. By saying she died, it gave the impression as if this was something natural. The New York Times put a similar misleading headline on May 12th about her executioner-style killing. It said, Shirin Abu Aghla, trailblazing Palestinian journalist, dies at 51. Compare this to its headline of March 13th regarding Brent Renaud. Brent Renaud, an American journalist, is killed in Ukraine. Shirin Abu Aghla was also an American citizen, but such information was largely missing from media or even official U.S. reports. Why the contrasting descriptions? Further, the Times merely re-argued Israeli propaganda that there was firing between Palestinian gunmen and Israeli regime forces. This has since been debunked by eyewitnesses as well as CNN. Renaud died when the car was traveling, came under fire at a checkpoint in Ukraine. Abu Aghla was specifically targeted by an Israeli regime sniper. He knew precisely that he was targeting. The bullet was fired using a US-supplied M16 rifle with a telescopic sight that fired at the small opening between Abu Aghla's steel helmet and her bulletproof collar. It was a targeted killing. Under Nitzan pressure, the NYT corrected its headline, but its pro-Israel bias was clearly evident. Let us, however, return to the issue of fears about the Zionist regime's survivability. Several factors can be cited. While indulging in extreme cruelty against the Palestinians, targeted killings, home demolitions, night raids on Palestinian homes to arrest people, and imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, including women and children, it has successfully peddled a narrative of victimhood. The Western corporate media simply parrots this nonsensical lie. Western regimes led by the US but now joined by Britain, France, Germany and Canada, among others, have also launched vicious campaigns criminalizing calls for boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement. In the Queen's speech in Parliament last month, the Boris Johnson regime declared it would ban local councils and other public bodies from participating in boycott and divestment campaigns. France has banned marches that criticize the Zionist regime's crimes and invasions. Similar restrictive policies have been implemented in Germany. Both in the US and Canada, similar campaigns have been launched to stifle criticism of the Zionist regime's crimes. For instance, 27 states in the US have forbidden campaigns and educational institutions from joining the BDS campaign. In Canada, both the federal government and the Ontario provincial government have signed onto the International Remembrance Alliance definition that equates criticism of the Israeli regime with anti-Semitism. It has faced pushback from academic institutions as well as from many fair-minded Jewish groups. Why are these regimes so desperate to ram down the throats of their citizens' policies that clearly violate the fundamental rights of the people? They are supporting an oppressive colonial settler entity in the West Asia region. Therein lies the crux of the matter. Despite being most ruthless military machine in the West Asia region and beyond, the Western regimes see in occupied Palestine their own past. Canada and the US are colonial settler entities. The European settlers perpetrated genocides against indigenous peoples in North America. Most of them came from Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal. The Western regimes do not see anything wrong with the fake regime of Israel indulging in similar genocide of the Palestinian people. In fact, they applaud such despicable conduct because it validates their own past behavior. The challenge that Zionist Israel faces today is that it is virtually impossible for it to wipe out the Palestinians as was done by the European settlers many centuries earlier. The socio-political and information environments are very different today. The alternative media continues to expose the ugly face of Zionism and its barbaric practices against the Palestinian people. Amnesty International has exposed the apartheid nature of Israel, as has the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in its annual report into the human rights violations in Palestine and other occupied Palestinian territories. The UN report follows the publication of similar findings of Israeli apartheid by Human Rights Watch, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, and Israeli human rights organizations B'Tselem, Yeshdin, and many other international and regional human rights organizations. Not surprisingly, the Zionist regime clamped down on Palestinian human rights organizations for documenting its violations of human rights of the Palestinians and advocating for accountability by all duty bearers. In October 2021, the fake regime of Israel outlawed 6 Palestinian human rights organizations, accusing them of aiding and abetting terrorism. Concurrent with these, the resistance front is becoming increasingly sophisticated. Comprising Islamic Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Palestinian Islamic groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Syria, and Ansarullah in Yemen, and resistance groups in Iraq have all become formidable opponents of the fake regime of Israel and the Zionist entity. It is, however, the solidarity of movements in Western countries and around the world, and the growth of BDS movements on campuses that frightens the Zionist regime so much. Similarly, its own population has no confidence in its long-term survival. The end of Israel is writ large on the wall.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-purification as agent of development. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-purification as the agent of self-development. When we look at the human body, we see that, of course, in the same way as the body is forced to endure a certain amount of hardship in order to fulfill its vital functions, like eating, like earning. So we go out, we work hard, and maybe we sacrifice the sleeping time. Maybe we are sacrificing the time that is being used for the rest. Maybe someone is sick or ill, or maybe he has a headache. And even with all those things, he goes to the work. Why? Because he knows that he needs to earn. He needs to bring some money. He needs to have some sustenance. And in order to have that sustenance, even if he has a pain, he goes to the work. He sacrifices for it. And he has the hardship he faces. He faces the hardship. On the other hand, there are some professions which are really having a lot of hardship in it. For example, when we see people working on the building a structure manufacturing a building or maybe manufacturing other things. There are many other things. There are many other jobs that requires hardship. So we see that the body is forced by the man, by humans, to endure a certain amount of hardship in order to fulfill its vital functions. And even we can see, like, for example, the sportsmen, the bodybuilders, they are also forcing their body in order to have this hardship and to bear this hardship in order to fulfill the function that it has. Therefore, we see this over there, that this is how a person reacts when we look apparently at a person as a human being. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-purification as the agent of development. We said that we see that when a body is forced to endure a certain amount of hardship in order to fulfill its vital functions and in order to provide the sustenance that it needs in order to have this world, or we need to spend a good life in this world, we put some hardship on ourselves. Same is the case with the spirit and the soul. And the spirit also must put up with pain and toil in the course of moral developments. If we want to have the moral developments, if we want to have spiritual developments, if we want to have self-perfection, it is necessary to put the spirit in the pain and the hardships in order to reach all these perfections or the developments that we are looking forward. All the various concepts and principles in the field of character building revolve around the axis of the soul or the spirit. It is spirit which is capable of reform and discipline. It is spirit which is capable of attaining sublimity and acquiring higher human qualities and excellences, loving as it does spiritual perfection. And finally, it is spirit which generates a series of ethical laws for the human being that the animal neither possesses nor requires. Therefore, it is necessary to have this hardship, the hardship of bearing waking up on the time for the morning prayer, for example, the hardship of spending some money for the needy people, giving away some money as a charity. So all these things, we think these are the hardships, but these are the things that takes us towards the perfection, that helps us to gain the self-perfection. And the self-perfection is in giving away and in helping people and in building the good society with the good ethics, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. In the United States, the Manhattan District Attorney is continuing to investigate former President Donald J. Trump, but knowledgeable people say charges are unlikely to occur in the foreseeable future, if ever. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Ben Protest, Jonah Bromwich, William Rashbaum, and Lana Nguyen. The piece is titled "Likelihood of Trump Indictment in Manhattan Fades as Grand Jury Wraps Up." When some two dozen New Yorkers filed into a Manhattan courthouse to finish out their grand jury service, the case against a man who would have been the world's most prominent criminal defendant was no longer before them. That man, Donald Trump, was facing potential criminal charges from the grand jury this year over his business practices. But in the weeks since the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, stopped presenting evidence to the jurors about Donald Trump, new signs have emerged that the former president will not be indicted in Manhattan in the foreseeable future, if at all. At least three of the witnesses, once central to the case, have either not heard from the district attorney's office in months or have not been asked to testify, according to people with knowledge of the matter. In recent weeks, a prosecutor at the Manhattan District Attorney's office, who played a key role in the investigation, has stopped focusing on a potential case against Donald Trump. Other people with knowledge of the inquiry have said, a move that followed the resignation earlier this year of two senior prosecutors leading the investigation. And the remaining prosecutors working on the Donald Trump investigation have abandoned the war room they used to prepare for their grand jury presentation early this year, the people said, leaving behind an expansive office suite and conference room on the 15th floor of the district attorney's office in Lower Manhattan. The grand jury's expiration at the end of the month does not preclude prosecutors from impaneling another jury. But the developments underscore the reduced possibility that Donald Trump will face charges under Alvin Bragg, who, along with several other prosecutors, had concerns about proving the case. Some people close to the inquiry believe that it will not result in an indictment for the former president unless a witness cooperates unexpectedly, a long shot in an investigation that has been running for more than 3 years. In recent weeks, Alvin Bragg's prosecutors have issued a few additional subpoenas that indicate they are continuing to investigate but have not found a new path to charging Donald Trump. The previous unreported subpoenas, people with knowledge of the matter have said, appear to focus on the same topic that has long been the subject of the investigation: whether Donald Trump falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. The subpoena suggests that, rather than pursuing a new theory of the case, Alvin Bragg is looking at additional entities that received Mr. Trump's financial statements as he sought loans and pursued other business, and that the prosecutors are seeking potential victims of the former president. One of the subpoenas went to a major financial institution that may have received Donald Trump's financial statements. A second subpoena, sent to the Trump Organization, largely followed up on an earlier demand to the company for records related to the value of its properties. And a third subpoena went to the New York City agency that tracks municipal vendors, including Donald Trump, who has done business with the city for years, operating a golf course in the Bronx and an ice rink in Central Park. In an interview this month, Alvin Bragg said that his prosecutors were interviewing new witnesses and looking at additional evidence. He declined to provide any details, citing grand jury secrecy law, but said that the inquiry must be allowed to run its course. "It's a work in progress," Alvin Bragg said, adding later, "We've got seasoned prosecutors working every day. It's not going to be on a timeline." But impaneling a new grand jury could create challenges for any potential case. Donald Trump's lawyers could argue, and a judge might agree, that prosecutors were inappropriately hunting for a more favorable group of jurors. It would also take time to prepare a new presentation of evidence and months to lay out a case to jurors. Alvin Bragg's office does not have unlimited time to charge Donald Trump. Witnesses could forget key information. Prosecutors would also face a deadline to file the charges within 5 years of any crimes being committed, though there are some exceptions that extend that deadline. And were Donald Trump to announce another presidential run, Alvin Bragg would be likely to face political pressure not to indict a leading contender for the White House. But even as the criminal investigation fades from public view, the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, appears poised to take action against Donald Trump as part of her inquiry into whether he falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. The same conduct at the center of the criminal investigation. At a court hearing on Monday, 25th of April, a lawyer from her office said that the Attorney General, Letitia James, would probably take action against the former president in the near future. Because her investigation is civil, Letitia James can bring a lawsuit, but not criminal charges. At that hearing, a judge held Donald Trump in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a subpoena for records from Letitia James. And on Friday, despite Donald Trump's lawyers having filed documents that they said brought him into compliance with the subpoena, the judge declined to withdraw the contempt order, which is costing Donald Trump $10,000 a day. Mr. Trump has long denied wrongdoing and accused Letitia James and Alvin Bragg, both of whom are black and Democrats, of being politically motivated racists. If he ultimately is sued or indicted, his lawyers would be likely to point towards the disclaimer that his financial statements were not audited by his accountants and that they were submitted to sophisticated financial institutions that conducted their own due diligence. Alvin Bragg's office is monitoring Letitia James's civil investigation for potential new leads, he has said. And Ms. James's office is participating in the district attorney's criminal investigation opened by Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus R. Vance Jr., more than 3 years ago. In December, Cyrus Vance directed the two senior prosecutors leading the criminal inquiry, Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, to present evidence to a grand jury with the goal of seeking an indictment of Donald Trump. But when Alvin Bragg took office this year, he and several of his aides raised concerns about the strength of the case, questioning whether they could prove that Donald Trump intended to break the law. Other prosecutors in the office had raised similar concerns, people with knowledge of the matter have said. In the final months of Cyrus Vance's tenure, three assistant district attorneys stopped working on the investigation, concerned about how rapidly it was proceeding and what they felt were gaps in the evidence against the former president. Alvin Bragg eventually decided to halt the grand jury presentation, prompting the departure of Kerry Dunn and of Mark Pomerantz, who stated in his resignation letter that he believed that Donald Trump was guilty of numerous felonies. Just weeks after their departure, Solomon Shinarok, one of the key prosecutors on the team, stopped investigating Donald Trump. Mr. Shinarok, who for years was the lead assistant district attorney in the investigation, pulled back in part because it appeared to be winding down, two of the people familiar with the inquiry have said. The Daily Beast first reported that Mr. Shinarok was no longer actively involved in the investigation. While Mr. Shinarok is not investigating Donald Trump, he's still working on a Trump-related case. In July, Manhattan prosecutors indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing him of a years-long tax evasion scheme. Mr. Shinarok is playing a central role in preparing for that trial, and given that role, is participating in meetings where the investigation into Donald Trump is discussed, a person with knowledge of the meetings have said. In the interview this month, Alvin Bragg said that no one had left the Trump team since Kerry Dunn and Mark Pomerantz. Asked this week to clarify his remarks, Alvin Bragg's spokeswoman stood by them, saying that there was one dedicated team working on the indicated tax case and the Trump investigation. The team is led by Susan Hoffinger, an experienced prosecutor from Alvin Bragg, appointed to lead the officer's investigations division. The spokeswoman, Danielle Filson, said in a statement that the team included lawyers who have worked on the case for years and skilled new prosecutors with decades of experience and fresh eyes. She declined to say how many prosecutors and other staff are assigned to the team investigating Donald Trump, but said it was actively probing unexplored avenues. In the early days of Alvin Bragg's tenure, the core members of the Trump team took over a 15th-floor conference room as they pushed ahead with the presentation of evidence about the former president to a grand jury. But since the resignations of Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, the team has abandoned that room, an indication veterans of the office say that the case is not headed towards a grand jury anytime soon. The team members are now sitting in offices in the Major Economic Crimes Bureau.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on 6 key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Most of Iran consists of a youthful population born after Imam Khomeini's blessed life had ended. They were either born after he passed away or were young children at that time. But these faithful youth, living in various parts of the country, loved Imam and his memory so much that it's as if they had been in this company all along. As we say in Samad supplication, we rightly and sincerely put our faith in him without being able to see him. They enjoyed pure and sincere faith without having been born during the Imam's lifetime and without having the opportunity to listen to his remarks. This is not peculiar to our nation alone. In many parts of the world, as well as in Muslim countries, people have the same feeling towards Imam Khomeini. This reality is the result of 2 factors. One is the greatness of the Imam and the various aspects of this personality, which was unparalleled in recent and contemporary years. The other factor is the greatness of this revolution.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is the greatness of a deed that our magnanimous Imam accomplished in the present era by relying on his faith, acumen, and a strong determination. This deed was his initiation of the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic. The greatness of this revolution is indicative of our magnanimous Imam's greatness. Iran's revolution was a divine miracle. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, left a perpetual guideline for his ummah, our nation, with his words and deeds, meaning that the words of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, guide us through all difficult stages of life. And his testament is one of the best and most influential moral legacies of his time. It is advisable that the people, the different officials, and all youth refer to his statement at different times and reflect on it. Let me refer to some of the points mentioned in Imam Khomeini's testament, which is full of useful meaning. The first point is that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, insisted in his testament on the fact that the Islamic Revolution is a divine revolution, and it is mainly based on the will of the people. The Islamic Revolution belongs to the people. This means that no individual, social class, or group can and should claim to be the owner of this revolution and consider others as a subsidiary.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Avdiivka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Avdiivka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Avdiivka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here, but I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy.
If Russia attacks Ukraine, there will be sanctions. When the US bombs Iraq, no sanctions. When Saudi Arabia bombs Yemen, no sanctions. When the EU destroys Libya, no sanctions. When Israel colonizes Palestine, no sanctions.
When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know that war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of €2 billion under the European Peace Facility
helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now, for Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. And what was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country. And that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner.
Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. The Great Recession began. Seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
C'est pire.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Nakba Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and disposition of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Nakba Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and disposition of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or good, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country expressed concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people's suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60 to 70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Again, the Western bloc, including the U.S. and the U.K. Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pakistan has joined the rest of the Muslim world to condemn the Indian ruling party. Two senior officials of the Bharatiya Janata Party recently made derogatory remarks that disrespect the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Indian envoy in Islamabad was summoned by the Foreign Office to record a strong protest. In a statement, Pakistan says the remarks have not only deeply hurt the sentiments of the people of Pakistan, but billions of Muslims around the world.
People in Pakistan are outraged by the insulting remarks. They are demanding strong action against those Indian officials, as well as calling on the Muslim world to put up a united front against this religious bigotry.
After uproar in the Muslim world, the Indian ruling party suspended its two officials, but people feel that is not enough.
This is a test for the OIC. The OIC has issued a statement, but it is not enough. This OIC must take a stand and raise this issue with Mr. Modi.
We condemn this. Such sentiments against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, hurts the religious sentiments of Muslims.
Pakistan's leading religious clerics have also condemned the insulting remarks.
All religious schools of thoughts in Pakistan have unanimously condemned what happened in India. We will work together and evolve a joint strategy against this incident.
The controversy has strained India's relationship with the Muslim world. Experts believe Indian ties could further deteriorate with the Muslim world if its leadership does not extend a public apology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Families of Palestinian prisoners and rights activists have held a sit-in protest inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of some 5,000 political prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as some 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for the military court hearings for more than 6 months. These detainees are held in Israeli jails without charge or trial for a long time. Their only recourse to call attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food for more than 3 months, and Raed Rayyan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since more than 2 months ago.
We are talking about the Palestinian administrative detainees who are boycotting the Israeli